Welcome to Horse First with Lockie Phillips, a podcast about paying closer attention to the horse, to the work that we do with horses, and paying attention to what's actually happening in front of us. Not what looks good, not what we've been told looks good, because sometimes we slow down and sometimes we speed up, but we don't pretend. I'm Lockie Phillips. Let's begin. In today's episode, me and my guest go into places that I have never gone to before on this podcast. And I have a guest who I've never kind of had a guest like this before on the podcast. I'm so excited to introduce you to Sophie Strand. Those of you who know who Sophie Strand is, I know you're already pumped and stoked to hear our conversation that's about to follow. But if you don't know who Sophie is an author based in the Hudson Valley in the United States. And her work moves through so many worlds, including, but not limited to, ecology, mythology, animism, the body, illness, and our relationship with the more than human world. I invited Sophie onto Horse First because I've started to wonder whether the horse is actually kind of a Trojan horse, a symbol that's carrying greater meaning, messages, and lessons for us into not just the human world, but into the world overall. So we think we've fallen in love with horses, we think we're learning horsemanship, but somewhere along the way, horse people start to discover that this beautiful animal starts to change the way that we relate to everything, the way we relate to land, weather, to other species, to our own bodies, to consciousness, to even illness and death, even to what we think is alive, what we think is intelligent, or what we think is sacred. Sophie has an extraordinary way of thinking about all of these things, in my humble opinion. I think she's a leader in thinking about all of these things. And this conversation went into places that I have, in fact, never gone to on this podcast before. So today we're going to follow this Trojan horse out of the horse world and see where it takes us. Please welcome Sophie Strand to the podcast. I'm sitting here with the author, Sophie Strand. Sophie, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it's really a pleasure. So I got into your writing recently and I'm very new to your work because of my friends and my interns, Molly and Lucas, who are also here listening to this conversation. So I'm brand new to your world and deeply, wildly, passionately excited about your work. And I'm very excited to speak with you more about it. But for those listening who do not know who you are or what you do, how do you describe yourself to the uninitiated?
Oh, I'm always worried when I'm encouraged to self-capture. I think the minute we identify ourselves, we create a bit of a box. I am technically a writer at the intersection of spirituality, ecology, and myth. But mostly I'm a lover. I follow my love like a bee follows its appetite into the flower and incidentally pollinates other beings in the process. I'm a lover. I'm not an expert, but a writer of books about things that I love.
And what are the things that you love?
What are the things that I love? Well, I met those intersections, spirituality, ecology, folklore, fungi. I mean, the list goes on, right? And love stories. Right now, I'm actually doing a deep dive into the history of love stories and trying to compost it with modern science. And and to take some of these stories that have become kind of too ossified, not super nourishing, and make them into something wilder. What do you love, Lockie?
Well, I love horses and I'm a little bit obsessed about horses and I love people who are passionate and people who are lovers. And I feel like reading your book, The Flowering Wand, I felt like I was getting pollinated
by your work, because I'd never heard anyone write about that subject the way you had. So could you describe in your own words what the Flowering Wand is about, what led you to it?
Yeah, it's a bit of a wild story. The Flowering Wand is a book of experimental essays that rewilds the sacred masculine, that takes patriarchal masculinity and says this is a monomyth that doesn't describe most of human history, and that masculinity is as biodiverse as a forest. There are many different species and so many healthier modes that we've forgotten. And it's not healthy to masculinity in the present day to pretend like there's only this one option. And so it was my kind of wild romp with fungi, with Dionysus, with invasive species, with Merlin, and all of these different beings who've been my co-conspirators for a long time, kind of wading back into these myths, looking at the ways they had been misinterpreted and misused by empire. And uprooted from their original health and ecological responsiveness. And the project really was not something I would have ordered off the menu. I had spent years writing a historical fiction retelling of the story of Mary Magdalene and kind of rewilding the oral storytelling magical healer that in Aramaic would have been called Yeshua, and then becomes mistranslated and becomes the Roman imperial Jesus. And so I spent a lot of time researching the Mediterranean basin and its mythologies of dying and resurrecting vegetal gods. So Dionysus, Attis, Adonis, Osiris, leading to Jesus. So I spent so many years in this research. And then that book, that fiction book, was not selling. It was early COVID. I was disabled and isolating alone and really sad and really lonely and very sick. And so I started to write these essays about masculinity as just kind of exploring this research I'd already done and giving them away for free online. And, you know, lo and behold, they featured spores and fungi heavily, and they sporulated. They took off. They went viral. And I wrote the book in 3 weeks, and the book sold to an editor in 3 weeks. It was one of the craziest moments of my life. And you know, I've made a prayer to Dionysus before I started the project. I just said, like, I'm really depressed and really sick. Help me keep going. And he did. It was intense, though. A complete pivot. And I never expected that my first published book under my own name would be about masculinity. I in no way think I'm an expert on masculinity. I more went in as a lover and someone exploring. But yeah, that book is incredibly earnest, I would say. It's really like the things I'm most passionate about and care most about. And I'm really honored that it has, you know, the spores have traveled on the winds as far as to you in Spain.
Yeah, and I had never heard some of the ideas that you love in that book. I'd never heard them expressed in that way before, but when you had expressed them, they both felt new and familiar at the same time. It was old and new at the same time. It was at the same time a dawning aha moment of a realization and a deep, like, slapping of the forehead, like, duh, of course, kind of happening simultaneously. So it doesn't surprise me that it kind of grabbed your life by the horns and steered you in this sort of direction, because it was really an inspired, totally inspired moment. Something was speaking through you, I think, which is kind of where I'm leading to. And this is actually a question my friend Molly here kind of explored, this idea of the Trojan horse, that there's something inside of us that, by virtue of our shell, we can go into new places to say certain things, but really there's other messages inside that we're protecting in order to get past certain boundaries. I do a lot of this in my work, And I feel like you might do a lot of this also. What does it mean to you to have things speak through you rather than you speak through you?
This is very synchronous because I've actually been in a very deep study of the Trojan War and the Trojan Horse, like in the past couple of months and in the past week. So this feels like one of those cosmic wake moments. I'm also very curious about how this manifests in your own life, like what you are a Trojan Horse for. Well, I'll answer this, and then I'd love to hear about how it manifests in your own life. I always think that we are Trojan horses for other species, that we look like we have a skin silhouette and we're a single species, but we have more microbial and fungal cells in our body than we do human. And at our best, we provide a mouthpiece for other species. We learn how to, there's this amazing sea louse that goes into a fish and eats out its tongue. Effectively, kind of like a little bit of a horrific metaphor, but the fish doesn't die. And then the louse becomes effectively the tongue of the fish. And I think sometimes, especially when we're living in paradigms of oppression and ecocide and genocide, the only way to really change a story is to become the sea louse going in and eating out the tongue and becoming the tongue. Speaking through the mouth of patriarchy, speaking through the Trojan horse, but in such a way that you hijack the system and take it over and change the narrative. And I mean, for me, my favorite example is fan fiction, which often goes into stories and myths that have been written to exclude certain people, queer people, disabled people, people who are not white. And the best thing you can do as a fan fiction writer is go in and explode it from the inside. And so for me, especially, I mean, with the Flowering Wand, I was very consciously praying to fungi, mycorrhizal fungi in particular. I was saying, use me, dream me. And I know I'm a faulty translator. Like, I know I have to keep checking in and remain humble and realize that I misunderstand you, but make me your servant. That's me. You know, I'm very interested in ideas of possession and how, you know, there's this, in Candomblé, there's this idea of divine horsemen, and Maya Deren's amazing experimental filmmaker made an incredible documentary about it, which is, you know, it's part of the tradition is being possessed and letting your body be possessed by spirits and ancestors. But that takes a lot of practice, and we have forgotten how to let ourselves be possessed by elementals, by other species. So we will pathologize certain states of being, anguish, depression, mental illness, when in another scenario, they might be these moments when we are being used as a mouthpiece by another species. And so I'm very interested in how we can get better at being divine horses ridden by the divine. How can we let that happen to us again? So you actually have the real companion species, interspecies collaboration experience with horses. So I'm sure that you can add a lot to my metaphor. But I'm also curious about what being a Trojan horse means to you and how it manifests in your own life.
Well, I think my work, my business at this time, I've kind of given my identity to my work at this moment temporarily, because my dream is to disappear on horseback into nature for as long as possible. That's my dream. I don't want to be in any kind of spotlight, just like you in a post-COVID time, around the same time as you kind of had an emergence. I had an emergence as well. And then I found myself in a micro spotlight in the horse world. And I've been conflicted about that, but I decided to Trojan horse myself, use whatever privilege I didn't earn as a flesh suit to insert myself into environments that someone with my ideas, my thoughts, my feelings, my hopes and my desires usually never are represented in the horse world in that space. But because I'm cis male presenting and white, and I'm a dude in a hat and a pair of Wranglers, or a dude in riding boots, and I'm apparently good with horses sometimes, I'm accepted into places where my voice can be spoken and some people sometimes will listen to it. if I was a person of color or a woman doing exactly the same work I'm doing, I'm aware that I probably wouldn't have a quarter of the privileges or access or spotlight that I've had. But I've decided to use those privileges that were given to me from patriarchy that I didn't earn. I've decided to use them and weaponize them against themselves to deliver messages that aren't anarchic in the chaotic or destructive way, but anarchic in the way that I want to see as many people as possible follow gentleness in places where there used to be only violence. That's really my purpose at this time. And I'm doing it for a limited time only, because my desire is to, again, disappear into nature on horses and not bother anyone. But that's also a little bit of a shadow egoic dream to not be of service to others. Do you relate to that?
I do. And I think it is complicated. My parents are writers and have worked in publishing. And I grew up in a very different age of publishing where writers could remain relatively private people and put out their books and from a distance, and you might never know what a writer looked like or what their views were or what they were like. It was their work and they put it out. And the truth is that it's not how publishing operates anymore. You have to be your own publicist. You have to be a personal brand. You have to be on social media. And this is really, really, really hard for me and really bad for my mental health long-term, I think. And I've always operated in the past 6 years when I went from having a private Instagram account with like 500 people to having a lot of eyes on me very quickly. I definitely got the bends, like to use the scuba diving metaphor. Like I went from having no eyes on me to having quite a lot. I've always done that knowing that the aim is to be off of technology and spending most of my time outside and feeding my real community, people, animals, plants who live within 10 miles of me, and writing books that save other people's lives, just like books saved my life, but using whatever those books do to nourish the plants and animals and people that keep me alive. And so the aim has always been to reach escape velocity with my career such that I can do that. At this point, I don't know if it works like that. I'm not sure. And so I do think there's going to have to be a point where I decide to unplug and to disappear. And to disappear in a way that's not about avoiding helping other people, but really only being available to the people and the beings in my community. And I feel spread thin and less nourishing the more time I spend online. And I think that the more and more these days, I think the fantasy of reaching some point whereby I see a clear out, it doesn't exist. You have to consciously decide to step away. And so, yeah, that's something I've been thinking about a lot. I really relate to what you're saying.
Yeah, that's totally been my experience too. One of my favorite phrases in any written literature anywhere was in Tolkien's Fellowship of the Ring, which you wrote about Tolkien in The Flowering Rond, and you had my attention straight away. But Bilbo saying, "I feel like butter scraped over too much bread." The most perfect
meme. I send that meme to my friends sometimes, actually.
Yes. Yeah. Butter scraped over too much bread. Cold butter over too much bread. When it like scrapes against the bread and balls up and it's disappointing, you know. Yeah, that's certainly been my experience too. And when I was going through a growth phase and I didn't know how to run a business at all, so I got help. And she said, "Do you want to have a big business or a small business?" And I thought, do I get to choose?
Yeah.
She said, "Actually, you are in a position where that very few people get, where you can choose." I said, "Look, I don't mind right now if I have a larger audience, if that means I can help more horses and help more people. But I want my daily experience of my work to be that of a very small business. And I've had to work at that structure to get it to that point. But that unplugging is so important. Last week, I unplugged, went to London, did something totally out of the ordinary for me. This week, I'm more or less unplugged from online, and I've got 15 people in my house all exploring community here in my environment. But the responsibility, like if we have a voice, if we have an idea, if we are driven to pollinate, or if we have a draw, if we're lovers, we end up kind of haphazardly finding ourselves in a leadership role. And I don't know, I'm only having conflicted thoughts about that and feelings, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I get very uncomfortable. We live in the culture of the guru, and it's very, people are really, really scared right now, and they're looking to outsource their intuition to other people. And that's a very understandable impulse right now. There's a lot of uncertainty. We're looking for people to give us advice on how to heal, how to feel better, how to live better. And it can be scary when suddenly you feel like you've been put in a guru position that you don't want to occupy. And I think one of the things that became very clear to me is I always self-identified as a fiction writer. And then what took off initially was my nonfiction writing. I never expected. Nonfiction runs the risk of encouraging a kind of easy, strident certainty and of expertism. This is how you do it. This is the truth. And I don't necessarily believe that's the best way of orienting or operating in the world. And it's been so interesting watching how people who have read my nonfiction relate to me and how people who have read my fiction relate to me. People who read my fiction come in and we're talking about the triangulation of my characters, not me, not them, not some like narcissistic self-help conversation, but we start talking about big civilizational questions, storytelling. Like for me, I think the best work I can do that puts me in relationship with people rather than in power dynamics with people is storytelling. The thing that scares me is when I find myself in not a leadership position, but in a position where people are outsourcing their intuition to me. And I want to say, look, give it back to yourself. Like I used to be a professional tarot reader for a while to make money while I was writing books. And it was really important to me to be like, we're doing a reading today, but throw out everything I'm saying. Like you, when I show you a card, the most important thing is not anything I say, but what you immediately feel. Like you are your own reader. You're reading me. I'm reading you. You're reading me. And like, you're saying that's total BS. Like, honestly, like it can make me feel really anxious to feel like people are looking to me as an authority. Do you deal with that level of anxiety? How do you navigate it?
I feel like you just described my life. I mean, it's definitely what I've what my student body, my inner circle of students have come to understand, know, and seek me out for. Is that I will refuse to allow them to give their autonomy to me. I will refuse to allow them to outsource their creativity to me. And I become a real stick in the mud about it, even urgently so. Having to say things at live demonstrations and workshops, I remember I was in Michigan once and I had to say out loud, your autonomy is really important to me. This is not mine to clean up. It's mine to help you find your broom if you've got a problem with this horse. And you speak about the characters and your storytelling and tarot. In the horse world, the horse stands in for all of those things. They stand in for storytelling. They stand in for tarot. They stand in symbolically for the characters and the stories we tell about ourselves. And what's happened in the horse world in the last 5 or 6 years is as people continue to move away from a post-industrialist age and horses are no longer needed in the center of human society for work, agriculture, for transport, we're still trying to redefine our oldest interspecies relationship. Who are horses to us now? Yeah. Are they sport equipment? Well, maybe not when they're used like that for sport and they are under distress for our clout. And so people continue to re-examine, wonder, and get curious, we hope, about who horses are in the human world now. And one thing that emerged was guru-centric self-help, unqualified self-help, unqualified therapizing with the horses as a style prompt.
Well,
that kind of emerged in the last few years. And I found it troubling to find that people who were career riders and trainers and horse people had now rebranded themselves as an equestrian Brené Brown, for example. And I found that really, really troubling. And meanwhile, the horses are in the middle of all of this, kind of looking to their left, looking to their right, and just wondering how to get through their day and how to collaborate with us. And what I'm trying to do is bring people back to their craft. Can we just build a relationship with this animal where we can create something together? Can we just go back to that? We don't have to use them. We don't have to exploit them. And they're not here to heal us. They're not here to inform us or to be our mirror. They're not here for any of that. They're here for us to enjoy and maybe live extraordinary lives next to them. It's like having shamans at home when you live with horses. They're just extraordinarily powerful. But this problem about the guruism and your work being influential to people, sometimes without you realizing that it was influential, and then you get put on a pedestal, and the discomfort you feel around people self-abandoning and using quote unquote your work as a vehicle for self-abandonment. How can we compost that, to use your own beautiful metaphors? How can we compost that into something that looks a little bit more like devotion and a little bit less like deflection?
I mean, I think for me, I studied very intensely in college hagiography. So this, how we beatify certain individuals and turn them into, so a hagiography is a saint's life. And it was one of the most popular genres of writing. In fact, the Romantic tradition and the hagiographic tradition are kind of sides of the same coin. The way we write love stories and fantastical stories have a lot in common with how we tell stories of miraculous individuals. And the wild thing is that there actually reached a point in the Middle Ages where people were living their lives with an innate understanding of what happens in a hagiography, trying to become a saint. I mean, the saint would have been at that time period the idea of the guru. And I think that, you know, people who we look to as being morally perfect were one second away from canceling them and from being upset when they're human. And it's a way of erasing humanity, erasing our own humanity. And I think for me, the way you compost it is something I try and do all the time is puncture people's expectations of what I'm supposed to be. So whenever I feel like I'm performing a version of myself that other people are expecting, I try and notice it and puncture it and say, actually, I am a human who makes mistakes. I'm not perfect. And I try and be honest about that with people as much as possible so that we're in, because here's the thing. I've been really guilty of it in my own life. There are people who I looked up to so much and their work meant so much to me. And then when they proved like fallible, I threw out their work. And that wasn't good for me and for them. The better thing would have been to understand how complex they were, take their work, continue being with it, and let them also be a human being alongside it. And so for me, I'm trying to see if there's ways that we can all mutually develop a higher threshold for being human together and not being saints and not turning each other into saints' lives and sharing the mess and the uncertainty. I think whenever we can say, I've changed my mind, that's radical. And I think that whenever you're in a position where people are looking to you, it's important for you to say, I'm evolving. I changed my mind. I was wrong about that. What are your ideas? How can we keep thinking together? Like, for me, that mutual constant coevolution and dialogue is the way of composting it. You're very much a teacher. How do you navigate that students and people who really are coming to you with, I'd say, like a pretty sacred desire to learn something? To be part of the tradition.
Yeah. And bookmark that if it helps. When I read The Flowering Wand, I could really sense the human beating pulse underneath all of it. I really sensed it. And there was it was tongue in cheek in so many places. And there was a glint in your eye in so many places. Layered, deeply layered under so many layers of study and devotion. But there was a tongue-in-cheek moment under there, and I thought, I bet she would be fun over a cup of chamomile tea. I think you would be a riot, you know, in a kitchen somewhere. But I really felt that in your work, and that was part of the reason why I loved the book so much. And when I read it, and not to, again, glorify you, but when I read it, I had it open on my kitchen island, and I live a pretty busy life. So while I'm waiting for the coffee to percolate, I'd read an essay. And then upstairs in my bedroom on my nightstand, at the same time, I was reading The Book of Lilith by Barbara Black. And to read The Book of Lilith and The Flowering Wand at the same time was like yin and yang, shadow and light. That was really fascinating to hold those two things at the same time, and it somehow kept me tethered to something outside of your work that enabled me to feel your work from a distance and not get so drawn in by the charisma of the concepts, you know?
I'm also a person who's reading like three books at once, reading while I make the coffee, and a healthy diet is, you know, the more foods we eat, the healthier you are, the more species in an ecosystem, the more resilient. More. Maximalist. Yeah.
Maximalist. So as a teacher, I've seen an archetype happen a few times, not that often, but a few times. Someone will come across my work, get really excited about it, feel like it's speaking for them. Then there's sort of almost an adrenalized draw to it. They get really into it really quickly. And there's, you know, often a little bit of love bombing happening at the beginning. And there's also a little bit of fear of me at the beginning and a little bit of a, whatever you say, I'll try, okay. And a little bit of, I can watch the self-abandonment happen. And that's always a little tricky for me because I'm trying to bring them back to their own talents, not mine. And I try to be respectful and I try to guide them back to their own self. But then everything will go fine until I say something that makes them uncomfortable on behalf of their horse. And then it's not an if, but when I do that, because the horses are often requiring it and they've hired me as a teacher and I reserve the right to be able to be a mouthpiece for their horse. I always say their horse is my client. You know, I'm trying to speak for them as best I can. And in that moment, that's often a schism where they'll either drop that sort of that pedestaling of me. They'll drop it entirely and now they're back in their body and now we can really begin the human work together. Or I'm the problem, I'm the bad guy, and I get put on their compost heap. And I've come to the point where I try to prevent that as much as possible. And I try to identify them before they get deep into the work with me so that I'm putting appropriate boundaries in place. But if it does happen, I'm not worried about it I try to make sure that they're safe, even if I become the bad guy. I try to make sure that they're safe. I try to make sure that they're okay, that they've got support and they're going in the right direction for them. But if I become the bad guy, that's fine with me. That's fine with me. I've kind of come to see it as part of the job description, part of the role sometimes. We can't be the good guy in everyone's story, nor should we try to be.
Well, you can't defend people who need you to defend them if you're everybody's good guy.
That's right.
Bad guy to somebody. And I thought about that a lot is, you know, I want to be here for a very specific group of people, which means I will be adversarial to others.
That's right. And I've tried to learn from Orpheus, for example, who I know you love also, who was talented and fantastic and a poet and a singer and could make the whole world spring with his song. And then at the last minute, he turned around. At the last minute, he fucked it up. And so I try not to turn around.
Yeah.
If I'm helping people go somewhere and getting people moving, I try not to turn around at the 11th hour. If they let go of that, if they don't come, if they choose not to follow.
That's a good way of putting it. That's a fantastic metaphor for teaching. Yeah.
Try not to turn around.
Yeah.
You just got to keep walking forwards because it's that they've got to do their end of the bargain and join or not, right?
Yeah. And they can force someone. If you pull them along, it doesn't count.
No, it doesn't. Yeah. It doesn't count, that push-pull. So I wanted to talk about, I know that you are someone who identifies as chronically ill. Could you just explore that a little bit? How has that come into your life, emerged into your life?
I would identify as chronically.
You don't identify. Okay.
And I don't know. I think whenever you say I identify as chronically ill, I don't like to say I identify as anything.
As anything. Got it.
When we name something, we concretize it, we pray to it. If attention is a sort of thing, what are we paying attention to? What are we praying to?
Right.
That's a paraphrase of Simone Bay. I technically have a genetic connective tissue disease that I inherited that was turned on by some factor of the exposome, so environmental toxicity, circumstances, early trauma. Who knows what the origin story is? I go into this in this experimental memoir I wrote called The Body is a Doorway, where I really look at our ideas of wellness and optimization. Is wellness something you can buy? Does it haunt those who are constantly deviant, who there's no cure available to? So yeah, my condition is degenerative and it doesn't have a cure. So that's a little bit of a tricky one. So I got ill at 16 and it took till 22 to get proper diagnoses. And, you know, in a lot of wellness memoirs or memoirs of healing, when you get the diagnosis and get the treatment, you get better. And then you tell your story and you uplift people. For me, it was, you will die of this. And it could happen in so many different, really gross, weird ways. And let's list them. And so a little bit into, and there's no cure. And it's going to cost you a lot of money. And so it was intense at 22 to inherit that story. And I have a lot of curiosity about placebo and nocebo. So placebo is a good story. It's when you know it is incredibly effective and that many sugar pills and placebo effects outperform the drugs they're supposed to be competing against. We know from the history of miracles, faith healing, that there's a very real component of healing, which is direct eye contact, belief, magic, that creates a theater whereby our actual immune systems wake up and perform real miracles in our bodies. Real thing. But most of for-profit medicine, especially in America where I live, is bad theater. No eye contact. Doctor doesn't remember your name, tells you a list of side effects and degenerative effects. Suddenly you're living out a story, a tragedy you didn't write. And it's very effective. If you tell someone they're going to experience bad side effects, even if they're made up, they're likely to actually experience them. So we have to be very careful in health and wellness about what stories we are telling. I never want to spiritually bypass either. And I think I've definitely been preyed upon by a lot of the you know, high vibers and the new age spiritual people who say that, like, this is a karmic debt. If you vibe up with your vibrations, you'll heal. And if you're not healing, it's because you're karmically murky and you're not doing enough work. And that's some, like, weird repackageism of Christianity, of, like, sinfulness and matter and
right.
Yeah, it's very, very toxic. And so for me, it's more about the being with and the growing alongside. Like, I have this part of me that I can't digest and I can't solve and I can't get out of. But what if it forces me into shapes that are more interesting than I might necessarily want to hold? And I see things from that perspective that help other beings. So how can my chronic illness be a doorway that is also the exact shape of another species? I was obsessed with mycorrhizal fungi at the same time as I got my diagnosis of a deficiency of connective tissue disease, which seemed for me like another cosmic wave, which is, I'm obsessed with the connective tissue of ecosystems. I have an insufficiency of connective tissue in my body. And if I can't cure my body, I can make myself the advocate for including fungi in conservation assessments, getting them better research, better funding, protected, understood. How can I become the co-conspirator of the connective tissue of the soil?
Yes. all of that, and I yes and that, because I've seen in the horse world a lot of that repackaged Christian shame and debt show up around
horses. Yeah, because I'm really curious about, like, how people are repackaged themselves as healers using the horse as some kind of, like, accessory to that experience.
That's exactly what's been happening, and it's a lot of there's therapy modalities, which there are good ones and there are problematic ones. I remain ambivalent about it. I've had other guests on the podcast and we've discussed that at depth. There's also using the horse as a personal development mirror that reflects back to you your confidence, your leadership style, your emotional valence. And it's sort of the horse becomes a diagnostic tool in a development, self-development journey. What we all know for sure is that when you work with horses, it is a gateway drug towards bettering yourself. We all know that for sure. And I have very good friends that are deeply invested in that world and do beautiful work there. It's not my work. I don't have to, because I think it happens naturally as a side effect. But what I know for sure is that this toxicity around my horse got sick, so it is my fault, or people saying that I have an emotional blockage somewhere and that has manifested in my horse as a disease, I think that's a leaky ship and we need to shore that up. I don't think that this transference doesn't not happen. I think it happens sometimes, but I think it's not a cause and effect. It's not neat and tidy in a box like that. It's a lot more nuanced. For example, my heart horse, my favorite horse in the world, and I don't mind playing favorites. I've known him for about 11 years, and he has what we think is irritable bowel syndrome, which is really tied to hypermobility, which is a tissue disorder, right? And for this reason, everything about him is stretched. The way he moves, the way he thinks, the way he feels and the way he applies himself to tasks is always stretched further outside the boundaries than people come to expect. So if a normal horse will work between 1 and 10, he works in negative 100 and plus 100 and the ranges of 10 at the same time. And so that's shown up in a way that I would come in a very stretched person physically. I'm a retired ballet dancer and also mentally had to stretch myself very far to live my life. I was overstretched. He's overstretched. We're like, we're brothers. We understand each other.
Yeah.
And therefore that work has enabled him to kind of stretch himself and speak for so many different type of horse problems that horses experience. And through one horse, I was able to understand 100. And then when I'm teaching with him, if someone is tight, braced, blocked, limited, self-limiting, self-limiting. All he does is just deliver that message to them gently. You are self-limiting, you are braced, and you are blocked, and that's all I will show you. And it's almost like his quote-unquote problem has become his solution. His disease has been integrated into his identity and then transferred over into the bedrock of how I show up in service and devotion every day in my work. So ask me again if I would want to heal him from that problem. Absolutely not. I would take him as he is every day of the week. And it's gotten me thinking about disease in a different way, that it's not a problem that we need to solve. Of course it is, but it isn't. It's more nuanced than that. If there's something
more nuanced than I always say, like, if there's a fix, give me the fix.
Right.
But there's also the story whereby I was a pretty PTSD, jangled, disassociated, wild kid. And had I not gotten sick, I might be dead now, you know, which is, and so that's, right. You know, when it cured immediately, I might be dead. And so I think a lot of people with illness can say that, which is just like, yep, this was my most profound teacher. Like this has become who I am and forced me onto a completely different path.
That it serves a totally different place in the environment. It has a function. That disease has a function in its environment. If my horse was living in a herd, his hypermobility and irritable bowel, if he ever found himself in a herd where he would be leading everybody towards movements that would keep the body together. That would benefit everyone. He would lead everyone in his herd towards food that wouldn't irritate the gastrointestinal tract, but would heal it. He would be searching for all of those things that he has a function in his society through that disease. And that disease kind of serves that strange function in a way.
That's so beautiful to hear. I mean, one of my favorite facts is that some of the oldest existing human burials where there's actual, like, you know, we didn't actually bury our dead for a long time, but in some of the oldest prehistoric burials, we found that these individuals were disabled, like a high number of them, and they're usually covered in shells and feathers. And these have been burials that were very potent and highly revered individuals. And in the disability community, it's often talked about, like, a high number of these people had experienced some kind of injury or genetic malfunction that definitely made them disabled.
And so they were venerated.
Yeah. And I think people on the edge, I love evolutionary biology as a kind of, like, magical way of thinking through things. And the truth is that every part of us began as a mistake. And that illness in a lot of ways is the edge, the most uncomfortable edge of evolution. It's a place where a body is experimenting with survival. Mm. And there's no such thing as a climactic species or a climactic body. Evolution is a stream of becoming. If you stop evolving, your species goes extinct. Mm. And the goal is to become another species or to dive into another species and become symbiotic, to keep changing and to keep surviving. And so ultimately, what sometimes begins as a glitch, a dysfunction, an inability, becomes perfectly adapted to a changing ecosystem. But that's a difficult, what I always say to people is that's a difficult edge to live in, is that place where your body is experimenting with survival. And it's dangerous, it's risky, and it's not comfortable. But it's that evolutionary erotic desire to keep changing shape, keep changing matter, and keep the evolutionary wheel spinning.
I feel like that role, that emergent edge of the mistake makers and the experimenters, whether we consciously chose into that or not, it's for some of us, not for everybody. And it's like a vanguard situation at the front lines of experimentation. And then our job is to pass that information but amongst horizontally those that are around us. Because if every horse in a herd had a disease the herd doesn't function, but you need a little bit of it, right? You need leaders and you need paces. You need all ages and all different styles of health, all different levels of health in order for the society to be healthy. Like my quote unquote career, such as it is as a teacher, didn't really begin until I had a catastrophic burnout that I've never fully recovered from. And I'm still in, like, 6 years later, a downstream side effect of it, where now I'm talking to my doctors saying, was it burnout or was this something else with my health that we're trying to understand? And we're going through a diagnostic situation at the moment. Long story long, I was mucking out a stable on the mountain in Spain one day, looking at the Mediterranean Sea out the window, and my energy just disappeared underneath me like a trap door. It just evaporated. I was the, like, fire. I'm an Aries, right? So I was just, like, burning across the hillside. And I was doing that all my life. And then suddenly one day the trapdoor opened and it all just evaporated on me. And it never really came back the way it used to. And I went to the doctor and the doctor said, you need to change your lifestyle, your career. So I had to change from this very active physical work where I was living in chosen obscurity, but the level of physical energy I had to express every day kind of kept me roped to a leaderless role. And then I had to reconstruct my life in a self-resting way.
Yeah.
But then that rest actually enabled me to put my ideas, which just belonged to me, out into the world. And then those ideas started my teaching career. And without that burnout, I would still be up in the mountains somewhere in obscurity, shoveling shit for somebody else. Not that there's anything wrong with a manure pile. You and I know that. But I've come to see that event with my health as a gift and an opportunity.
Yeah. I mean, it's very tricky. It lives well outside easy value dualisms of good and bad, or gift or curse. I always think of the pharmakon, which is this old Greek term for that which can be a poison or a medicine, depending on dose and context. And I think that, you know, I think illness is very much a pharmakon. It's a highly potent thing to interact with, and it can destroy us. And I think it's just about waking up every day and deciding pretty consciously to have it, to make sure that it's meaningful. Because I think it can be meaningless and it can feel absurd and it can feel tragic. And especially when illness is oftentimes the effect of, you know, entangled webs of oppression, whereby pollution and poverty and trauma are disproportionately foisted on the people who are not creating it. And so it's such a tricky thing. I mean, I think when we have the privilege of being able to stay alive and to work with it, we can access that gift edge of it, that potion side of pharmacon. And so for me, it's not much about doing that, knowing how many people I love just died. Just committed suicide, just died of cancer, just died of ALS, like just so fast. And not wanting to act like they didn't do it right, or like, you know, I think it's so important to always hold that wide curiosity about how we choose to make meaning from our circumstances. And I think that's really what it is. You know, Viktor Frankl writes about that, and his discussion of the Holocaust is just like, there is a way of looking at what is happening in the world and say, and to say, there's no framework that's robust enough to hold this. I've seen things in my life that are so horrible and experienced them in a pretty intense face-to-face, body-to-body way. I don't have a framework to explain them. They explode any spiritual framework anyone even tries to give me. And yet I have to choose every day to decide to make a narrative whereby this is meaningful and medicinal. So I do think there's this active and personal storytelling and meaning-making effort that then transformed something that could have been a poison into a medicinal potion. That is through, that has to pass through your body and be alchemized and then gifted to the world. Because there are plenty of people who, yeah, I've always want to be careful, because I know that in my readership, my audience, there are people who are actively dying right now, and fast and young, of things that they shouldn't have to be experiencing. And I always want to hesitate to call it a gift. I want to say, like, this is outside our umwelt, our sensory affect space, our ability to make sense. We're ants to this. We're never going to see the long story that makes sense of this. Yeah.
When I was a dancer and I was working with horses at the same time, and I got back into horses later in life, when I was 21, still very young, but returned to horses after a childhood with horses, adolescence without them, young adulthood, they came back into my life as a dancer. And I realized that the horses were being treated as creatures of movement without a voice, being used for what their body could do. And I realized that was very similar to my experiences as a dancer. Dancers are treated in exactly the same way, underpaid, often dominated by their leaders, and learn how to be resilient, or they push back against it, or they have to like horcrux themselves in order to get through their career. And not to make a J.K. Rowling reference here at this moment.
Unfortunately, a good metaphor, but yeah.
Unfortunately, a good metaphor. Yeah. We have to give her that.
I love all the people who write fan fiction that upsets her. Just go in and compost.
Perfect. That's absolutely right. Explode that from the inside out. But that's really what drew me to the way I'm working with horses now, is that experience. And what I see a lot of is exactly what you said. A lot of ways these animals, these beautiful animals, are treated, there is no framework that can explain that treatment in an uplifting way. There is none. The way that they are often treated or trained, there's no uplifting framework there. And a lot of very talented people who love these animals are drawn into a career with them, only then to discover that once you're a professional, you have to subscribe to this list of problems that are heavily influenced by the disease or the infection of patriarchy. And they have to subscribe to them and sell their soul down the river in order to make a living doing this. And I see people step out of those systems and just not know what to do, not know how to tell a better story, not know how to reframe, not know how to pivot. And what I saw in your writing, though it wasn't about horses, it was a humanitarian invitation to learn how to reframe and learn how to get a wider view and learn how to tell your story in a way that enables something that can help you grow from even the darkest of moments. That's what I saw in your work, and you're kind of confirming that for me now.
I'm really glad that you crossed, and I'm also just really, really thankful you're doing this work. I have, from a young age, have just been very, very, very connected to animals of all shapes and sizes. And horses were some of the original beings that I felt very deep companionship with, and have been horrified at the ways we utilize and instrumentalize animals in our lives, rather than thinking of them as being equal people. You know, they're peoples with desires and wants and needs and creativity, and they are not our tool. And it feels like, yeah, the way you're talking about horses is something I don't hear from people very often in their relationships. I mean, you hear a lot about people talking about animals that like their totem, their spirit animal, the symbolism of the animal. I'm like, this is a being with wants and desires and family members and history. Like, how can you can be in relationship with that, but like, how can you really do that with a lot of humility? And so I just want to say thank you. I also want to offer, and I wasn't sure I was going to do this, but I have been, there's a joke in my family right now, which is I have been for the past 6-7 months obsessively dreaming that I am a horse.
Okay.
And we're done here. I mean, I've always loved horses. I'm always researching them. I when I write historical fiction, I also try and research them and research the practices that would have been used. And I was writing a book that involved a lot of horse riding and horses, and I wanted to be able to accurately describe their experience. And so I was doing a ton of research. And then, of course, Google got onto that. It was like sending me a lot of like, it basically thought I was a horse. It was sending me like horse medicine, horse food.
The algorithm has no chill sometimes. No chill. Yeah.
It was like, yeah, we know what you're doing. But for the past couple of months, I've been dreaming that I'm many different types of horses, wild horses, horses being horses at different time periods. And I've been like, what does this mean?
Okay. So my sorry to interrupt you, but my first
please, hit. This is the question.
Okay, so I've already understood the question. What is it? Yeah, it doesn't surprise me because horses are at a very important moment in history. They have been for about a century. And they're getting louder and louder and louder, and they're looking for mouthpieces.
Okay.
It does not surprise me at all that they have found your voice and have loused themselves onto your tongue, or at least are beginning to. And perhaps the fact that I've kind of emerged into your, you know, inbox one day and we're having conversation.
When you sent me that email, I was like, okay, I get it.
Okay, got it. Because, I mean, what did my friends Molly and Lucas have to go through for you guys to show up into my life? I mean, Molly, a year ago, you watched a random clinic and then we had these conversations. I mean, it was like a Pan's Labyrinth to even them to come into my life and then to leave a book on my counter. And now, so that doesn't surprise me because the horses are looking for voices that are not part of the horse world, but voices who are competent, warm, competent, capable enough to help them usher in something else for them, because so many of them over history have died for us and suffered for us. And
that's a huge inheritance. Yeah, I think about that all the
enormous.
Time.
Enormous. The dog, the horse, we built civilization on the back of the horse with the dog by our side. And the external civilization is done. We've got ice machines now, like it's good. Or their job is done, right? Our castles have been erected and fallen, erected again. So what is the horse doing now? What is their higher calling? If there is a higher calling, what is their purpose and their relationship to people now? What is our purpose for them? And that's all up in the air. And it's just like human society. It's very chaotic. It's a little scary. It's a little dangerous sometimes. And I'm coming into the horse world, quote unquote, as an outsider from the art world, from the performing art world, and have found a seat at a very long table. Maybe they're trying to speak through you. I don't know. So if you ever want to riff and jam on that subject, you let me know.
I do. Yeah. Well, side note, I want to spend more time with horses and not in a way that's using them or trying to get something from them. And that's something I've been curious about locally. So if you have any Hudson Valley ideas, you know, always let me know.
We're going to put our feelers out and find that out for you. Well, Sophie, I want to be respectful of your time. Thank you so much for this conversation. I really enjoyed having a chat with you.
Wonderful. Wonderful mind jazz right here. Yeah, count me as one of your new horse mouthpieces every year.
Got it. Yeah. Done. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's all for today. If something in this episode made an impact on you, I encourage you to take it with you to your next moment with your horse, because that's where this work and these conversations really come alive in what you do next. If you would like to support this podcast, a simple way to do that is by leaving a rating or review on Apple Podcasts,
Spotify, or Amazon. It would help more people to find these conversations, and it would mean a lot to me. Horse First with Lockie Phillips is the formerly Emotional Horsemanship podcast and is distributed by the Believe Audio and Video Network. And just a gentle reminder, the content of this show is for informational and entertainment purposes only. The opinions expressed are those of the host and the guests and are not a substitute for professional, veterinary, or medical advice. I'm Lockie Phillips. Thank you for listening.